It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we meet a Wisconsin author who brings to life the world of high-stakes online computer gaming.
First, weeks before midterm elections, former Secretary of Defense and CIA Director Leon Panetta has published a memoir critical of his former boss, President Obama. He says the president made three major mistakes: not negotiating a residual force in Iraq, not arming Syrian rebels in 2012, and failing to respond when Syrian President Assad used chemical weapons.
Leon Panetta was the U.S. Secretary of Defense, Director of the CIA, Clinton White House Chief of Staff, and U.S. Representative from California for 16 years. His new memoir is Worthy Fights. Secretary Panetta, welcome to Central Time.
Nice to be with you.
Well, here's some of your words. This town, meaning Washington, has been governing by crisis after crisis after crisis. Is there a structural problem, do you think, with our political system?
Well, you know, I said, we govern by leadership or crisis. And obviously, if leadership is there and willing to take the risks associated with leadership, then I think we can avoid crisis. But if leadership isn't there, then obviously what we do is we govern largely by crisis. And that's what's happening now. Now, you know, I think the real question is it doable for, you know, those that we have elected as leaders in this country to be able to come together and take the risks associated with leadership to do what's right? Or, you know, are they going to stand back and obviously be part of the gridlock and the stalemate that consumes Washington right now? And, I guess my prayer is that that ultimately there will be those who will step forward and say, you know, we can't afford to govern this way. The country can't afford to govern by crisis. We have to deal with the challenges that face the United States of America.
Well, looking at President Obama's leadership style, you praise him in some ways, but you're critical in others. You say he's in part discouraged by the way the political process works. You also accuse him of a lack of passion, a lack of pushing issues. Is this something about President Obama, or is it the system that he finds himself in?
No, I think we are living at a time when this is a rough time to be president of the United States. It's a rough time for that matter to be in the leadership or in the Congress, largely because there, you know, is a growing group of members, so-called Tea Party members, whose sole goal is to shut government down, to prevent government from doing what it needs to do to serve the country. And so there's a built-in resistance there, you know, that obviously creates some fundamental barriers to the ability to get things done. Having said that, I'm just a believer that, you know, having had to deal with some tough members during the time that I was in Congress and in the executive branch, that you cannot give up, that you got to keep fighting. You've got to keep pushing the system. You got to keep trying to be able to work with those who are willing. I guess what I'm urging both sides to do now is not to give up. There are too many important issues that are not being dealt with, related to the budget, related to immigration reform, related to infrastructure funding, related to energy, related to jobs and tax reform. I mean, these are all important issues for the country that need to be addressed. We cannot have another two and a half years of stalemate. It'll weaken this country.
Well, given that there's a divided Congress now, potentially Republican Senate and House come next year, what specifically can the president do to make headway with Republicans on any of those issues you mentioned, immigration reform, tax reform, infrastructure funding, you name it?
Well, I think he's got to he cannot just simply allow this stalemate and this gridlock to prevail, which means you got to engage. You got to get in the ring and try to see if he can work, with the leadership, regardless of who takes over power in the Senate or the House, to work with the leadership, to work with members, to try to develop the kind of compromises that can try to resolve some of these issues. I mean, you know, we with a little work, I believe we can pass immigration reform. I think, both parties, members of both parties are close to dealing with something like that. Infrastructure. There's a lot of support for infrastructure funding. I think the need is to sit down and try to, get a piece of legislation that both can support to move it forward. I think the same thing is true on trade. You can get a bipartisan group to agree that we pass fast-track legislation to be able to put in place some of the trade agreements that are important for our economy. I think the same thing is true for tax reform. So, it's not easy, but we cannot just simply stand back and allow gridlock to control this country.
Let's move into your brief running the Defense Department, previously the CIA. In your book, you are critical of some of the president's actions related to Iraq and Syria. Maybe we can get into that. But right now, today, do you agree with the president on his current plan of airstrikes against ISIS in Iraq and Syria and supporting moderates in Syria, the Iraqi government, Kurdish and Shia militia in Iraq?
I do. I think the president's making the right decision to conduct this war against ISIS, and I think he's taking the right steps to try to stem this terrible tide that endangers Iraq and Syria and parts of the Middle East, not to mention threatens our own country. So, the combination of putting in place counterterrorism operations, which is something we know how to do and do well, combined with some of our troops on the ground to help train and embed with the Iraqi forces to get them so that they will go in and try to obtain the territory that's been lost to ISIS. The use of airstrikes, is certainly helping to block some of the efforts of ISIS to gain territory, and then combine that with a coalition that's been established of these moderate Arab countries along with others. I think that represents the right steps to take. Now, this is going to take a long time. This is not going to be something that we're going to be able to deal with in a short period of time. It's going to take a great deal of effort. It's going to take a lot of patience. It's going to take a lot of determination. This country is probably going to be in a sustained war against terrorism for a number of years. So I hope the president and the Congress and the country are unified behind that effort to try to protect the United States.
Looking at our partners on the ground in both of those countries, the Iraqi army, the officers ran on first contact with ISIS. We have very uncertain partners on the Syrian side. The Turkish army apparently isn't going to get involved. Is it realistic to think we can beat ISIS without Western troops, maybe specifically American troops, directly on the ground in combat?
Well, I'm confident in our military leadership their ability to take on this enemy. As General Dempsey himself has said, it's going to take boots on the ground, but it doesn't have to be United States boots on the ground. We can work with the Iraqi forces to develop their capabilities and make them competent to be able to regain the territory that's been lost. I'm a lot more confident about our ability to work in Iraq with the security force, with the government, using airstrikes, using every aspect of our capability to be able to push ISIS back. The tougher challenge, obviously, is Syria because it is chaotic. And the real question there is how do we identify elements of the opposition that we can train and arm so that they can represent the boots on the ground that we need in order to deal with ISIS in Syria? I think that's going to be a much tougher task. But, I think that we have to rely on the advice of our military leaders and that the president needs to be open to listening to them to be able to adjust our policy and our strategy when necessary in order to deal with ISIS.
We're speaking with former U.S. Secretary of Defense and CIA Director Leon Panetta about his new memoir, Worthy Fights. We're back with former U.S. Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta. His new memoir is called Worthy Fights. We continue our conversation now about counterterrorism. Today we're talking about ISIS. Not long ago, it was al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and then all over the world in different places, the Taliban. We've been in Somalia, Yemen. We're playing whack-a-mole here with terrorist groups around the world. Yeah. Is there something more fundamentally big picture that we can do to prevent the next crisis instead of reacting to it?
Well, that's a very good question, and that's something that I think we do need to address, because I view what we're dealing with ISIS as very much a part of a larger continuum from 9/11. 9/11, we were attacked by al-Qaeda. We went to war against terrorism as a result of that attack. And frankly, you know, we made great progress at being able to go after their core leadership and damage their ability to be able to, again, plan another 9/11 type attack. But we're now dealing with terrorism having metastasized to ISIS and Boko Haram and al-Shabaab and throughout North Africa. I really do think we need a broad strategy against terrorism that largely relies on our counterterrorism capabilities. We have developed very good counterterrorism capabilities. What do I mean by that? The ability to identify the leadership of these groups, the ability to target that leadership, the ability to go after them in an effective way. We know how to do this, but we're going to have to do it not just against ISIS. We're going to have to do it against these other terrorist elements that can ultimately also represent a threat to our country.
Let's delve into that a bit. You've talked in favor of drone strikes in your book, but is that, in a sense, just creating the next generation of terrorists when countries see themselves as powerless, their sovereignty means nothing, civilian casualties along with these targeted strikes? Doesn't that have a payback in the next crisis and the next group of terrorists we have to deal with?
Well, I think what you've raised is are issues related to the comprehensive strategy that we developed to confront terrorism. And you're right. We can develop a strong military element to that strategy, and we can go after, those who would attack our country. That has to be part of the strategy. But we also have to make a very important part of the strategy: how do we deal with the cultural aspects, with the religious aspects, with the economic aspects of that part of the world that drives young people to engage in jihad. And that has always been a tougher task. But I also don't think that it's something we should give up on. The fact is, I've seen this, the Saudis have been working at trying to provide that kind of education system that will reach out to young people. I've seen it in the UAE. They too have developed that kind of aspect. I mean, we can learn from them. What are the steps necessary to try to address the very issues that inspire extremism in that part of the world? That has to be part of our strategy in confronting terrorism.
Well, along those lines, how do we deploy what's often called soft power, non-military power, non-intelligence power, in stemming anti-Western sentiment across the Muslim world?
Well, that's a challenge that I think the State Department, AID, other elements of our foreign policy have to engage in. What they need to do is to develop a strategy of how do we assist those countries that are willing, and I think in the end we have to be dealing with countries that are willing to work with us to be able to address this issue and try to help them in that effort. What are those steps that we can do to try to assist them in ensuring that that young people get the opportunities that they need? This is going to take a long time. There's going to be a need for some changes in some of these countries to be able to open it up so that young people have a greater say about their future. It's going to take changes in terms of economic opportunity and jobs and the ability to be able to develop the kind of security that they need for themselves and their family. The education system is going to have to be opened up so that everybody benefits, you know, from educational opportunity. I mean, those are big steps, and it's going to take time, but it has to be part of the effort if we're ever going to be able to succeed in being able to win against terrorism.
Turning to your tenure at the CIA, first of all, one political observer said, where'd that come from when you were offered that job? That was your wife. Why Leon Panetta, a guy known for budgets and domestic policy, in charge of the CIA?
Yeah, no, it was a surprise to me, too, if you want to know the truth. And I think when the president called, you know, I raised the question, why me? And he said the main reason was because he believed I could help restore the credibility of the CIA, which had been badly damaged because of, you know, enhanced interrogation techniques. They had a bad relationship on the Hill. They just were having a very difficult time.
In your view, you reviewed Bush-era CIA interrogation practices before your tenure at the CIA. Did the United States, via the CIA, practice torture against detainees?
I've always felt that that certainly some of those enhanced interrogation techniques, like waterboarding, you know, were the equivalent of torture, and for that reason, I opposed them, and was glad when the president issued his executive order eliminating the use of those enhanced techniques. I think that was the right thing to do. I think, you know, in many ways they violated the standards of this country, our values as a people. And besides that, I think, you know, in talking to the FBI director and others, there was really a feeling that we really don't have to resort to techniques like that in order to get the information we need to help our intelligence. So I'm glad we got rid of those techniques, and I'm glad that we now pursue interrogation pursuant to our values as a country.
What specifically had we done before then that we no longer do now when it comes to this enhanced interrogation?
Well, you know, there were a number of techniques that were involved, and as we all know, the primary one was obviously waterboarding, but you know, there were other techniques that were used that, you know, that used physical means to cause pain and get people to be able to talk. And, you know, as I said, I understand, you know, the concern at the time. I mean, sometimes we all forget what happened in the days following 9/11 when people were panicked about what else al-Qaeda would do. Would they bring a nuclear weapon into this country? Would they try to, you know, blow people up again in Washington or New York or elsewhere? And so there was a real kind of panic about, you know, what are they going to do next? And so I can understand, you know, the concern about how do we get intelligence? And I think that, you know, that concern obviously is what bred some of these techniques. But, you know, as always, whether it's World War II with the Japanese or whether it's dealing with al-Qaeda after 9/11, I think, you know, we also have fundamental values as a people pursuant to our Constitution. And I think I do not think we have to choose between our security and our freedom. I really don't. And hopefully we're now back in the right position.
Getting to the response to your new book, there's been some anger among Democrats, including Vice President Biden in a veiled comment, criticizing you for publishing this book while the president is still in office before midterm elections, maybe causing damage to the presidency. How do you react to that?
I think that, you know, in our country, you can't put history on hold. You can't put you know, debating the concerns about where this country is going for the future on hold. I think it's important to raise these issues. I think it's important for the administration to raise these issues, and I think it's important for the country to raise these issues.
Looking to the future, you've said that you think Hillary Clinton would make a great president. supposing that there is a new Clinton administration, would you see a role for Leon Panetta in it? What would you want that role to be?
No, not at all. You know, I've spent almost 50 years in public life. I've enjoyed the challenges that I took on, as I've explained in the book. But I'm back home in Carmel Valley, and with my family, and with my dog Bravo, and with my grandchildren, and I'm thoroughly enjoying the opportunity to be with them. And you know, of course, you know, I'm always available to try to help people. You know, in terms of you know, my thoughts and my experience, but as I've said to people, I'm very content now working in my walnut orchard and dealing with a different set of nuts.
Secretary Panetta, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That was former U.S. Secretary of Defense and CIA Director Leon Panetta talking about his new memoir, Worthy Fights. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we celebrate the writers of Wisconsin with a young adult author who's taking on the booming culture of online gaming.
But first, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Backyard beekeeping is on the rise, and not just in rural areas. In towns and cities all over the country, urban beekeepers are tending hives and harvesting their honey. In Madison, commentator Aaron Kloon checks out the new beehives in her neighbor's front yard.
Hey there, Bob.
Oh, hey.
Is it a good time to see bees?
Yeah, it is. It'd be easier if you put this hat on first.
Okay.
I gotta get the smoker out.
For Bob, there are a lot of good reasons to keep bees. There's his own garden, which definitely benefits from the bees' attention. There's the fact that on a macro scale, as much as 50% of our food wouldn't be available without pollination. Bob likes the idea that he's doing his part to keep bees and our food supply healthy. Plus, beekeeping runs in his family.
My very first memory in life was being stung by a bee with my dad's hives.
So your dad was a beekeeper?
He was a beekeeper and an organic gardener and, you know, was, yeah, loved to be outdoors.
So now we have these three-story yellow boxes.
Which are called supers.
Supers. And then each one has like dozens of bees crawling.
Whoa. There's probably 30 or 40,000 bees here anyway in two hives.
Bob, you don't even have gloves on.
Well, I'm going to put them on in a minute when I pull out the frames. But here you can see the different sized bees. There is a drone. The drone is a little bit bigger than the...
Well, I really like the idea of doing our part to protect the nation's bee colonies. I'm also a mom. My kids play a few yards from these hives. Oh, something poked me in the leg.
So you think you got one sting?
I think I did. It's my war wound. Maybe I've watched too many cartoons, but I kept imagining a black cloud of bees swarming through the neighborhood, stinging everyone to death. And I wondered if I was the only neighbor worried about that.
Well,
does it really work like that? Or
well, no, it can. I mean, it in fact, I talked to this gardener who had bees, and she told me that they're swarmed over here a few blocks away, and she said it was traumatic. As far as the neighbors are, I was worried about it. But, again, honeybees are pretty docile. You have to have them within a certain distance, so they tend to fly up rather than fly out because they have a flight pattern.
I see how they're kind of going. They kind of go to that little slot at the bottom, and then they kind of go straight forward out.
Yeah, well, there's some of those bees there are doing a little dance to tell them where the nectar is. The foragers will come in and tell the other guys, hey, look, there's a really nice bunch of flowers out that direction so far. And they'll roam up to 5 miles, but typically a couple miles is their range.
So I could be sitting in my backyard and some of your bees are over there.
Oh, absolutely.
Checking out my hydrangea.
Right. In fact, some of your flowers will make some of our honey, hopefully.
Neat. I'll work on my garden harder.
The more time I spent with the bees, the more comfortable I got. Not as comfortable as Bob's 7-year-old son, Sam, who came out in his bare feet in the yard to join us.
Yeah, so if they come at you,
yeah,
like if they're right in your face,
yeah,
and you're just like buzzing right there, just go wham.
Just swat at them. I'm going to chase them by you guys.
But I'm happy to have the bees nearby. And over time, I'm sure we'll start to get along.
Like that, you're going to get us all stung now.
Sam brushed it off him and got on me. Woo!
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janna. Catch more Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Television Monday nights at 8:30 p.m. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
The writing scene in Wisconsin is booming, from high-profile authors signed by major publishing houses to self-published authors with their first books. Today we sit down with Lawrence Tabak, a Madison author whose new young adult novel, In Real Life, just came out. It's the story of a 15-year-old math prodigy, Seth Gordon. Seth wants to devote his life to gaming and hit the big time in South Korea, where the top gamers are celebrities.
Lawrence Tabak joins us now. He's the proud dad of two game-obsessed boys who are doing pretty well for themselves. His new novel is called In Real Life. Lawrence, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much.
Well, your main character, Seth, is obsessed with being a pro gamer. This is his passion. Tell us about Seth.
Well, as you just mentioned, he's a 15-year-old boy living in the Midwest, and not unlike a lot of kids today, loves to play his computer games. The difference is that he is very good at it, so good that he actually can aspire to make a living at it. And while that may sound like a far-fetched dream, these days it's not.
And he plays something called Starfare. What is that?
Well, it's actually a made-up game for the book, but it's very close to a lot of the games which attract the biggest audiences. They're strategy games in which either individuals or teams of players battle in a sort of a electronic capture-the-flag mode, playing through heroes that they pick and emulate throughout the game, kind of as an avatar.
Well, he finds himself in a bind that lots of kids who love video games often find themselves in with their parents, and that is that they're passionate about these games, they want to play them, but their parents are doing this thing where they want to limit the screen time, don't want the kids on the computers all the time, and this is something that you actually went through as a parent as well. Tell me how you dealt with your own son's interest in video games.
Well, as you said, I'm not alone on this one. I think a lot of kids would spend virtually their entire day on the computer. And just like any kid who has a passion, it's important to try to provide balance in their lives. And that's something that my wife and I really struggled with as our kids got more and more involved in gaming. We really had a series of different decisions to make, including whether or not to actually provide the equipment. And our decision was not to buy gaming consoles, which were sort of the rage at the time, thinking that they would find something else to do, you know, read a book, go out and play in the street. Instead, they gravitated to the computer. So I guess I have some responsibility for driving them in that direction.
But we have to finish the story here because, you know, parents may think this is just a hobby that is sucking my child away from, you know, getting ready to be the next Nobel Prize winner. But you can go really far these days in achievement when it comes to video games. Tell us what your son is doing.
Well, in my own household, my elder son, who's now 26, became a really avid gamer, both throughout his teen years and then kept it up as he grew into college age. And by the time he was a senior at University of Wisconsin, he had achieved the number one ranking in the game of his choice. And when he told me that, I said, "You mean the number one ranking in your league?" And he said, "No." And I said, "Well, the number one ranking, like on your server?" And he said, "No." I said, "Well, what?" He said, "In the world." So that was a bit of a surprise.
What game was it?
It was called Heroes of New Earth, which is very similar to a lot of the most popular strategy games out there, a multiplayer game. And as a result, he was invited to join a pro team called SK Gaming and played on a pro team for a while. But the money is only more recently, I mean, even though that was just a few years ago, the money in terms of pro gaming has just escalated enormously. And we can talk about that.
Yeah, what kind of money are we talking about?
Well, let me bring it back to home, because here in Madison, where I live, there's a young man who grew up three doors down from me, who I was surprised to find out upon Googling that is one of the most famous video gamers, computer gamers in the country. And I've followed his career kind of closely since. He recently, this would be in July, played in the biggest esports tournament in the history. It was a tournament in Seattle, Washington, for a game called Dota 2. And he and his teammates ended up finishing third in the world, and they each took home over $200,000.
Wow.
So that was a bit of a shock. The winning team, a Chinese team, each of the players took home over $1 million.
Oh, my goodness.
And so this is something that is really breaking out and a very, very new phenomena.
Well, how big is the video game industry these days? How would you compare it to other industries?
Well, it's about neck and neck with the Hollywood and the movie industry. So it's really a big, big industry. And that crosses a lot of different segments. Here in Madison, we have some fairly prominent video game developers and companies. My son, who went on after his short career as a pro gamer, went to work for a company called Twitch in San Francisco. And Twitch just recently got bought out by Amazon for approximately $1 billion.
And Twitch is a home base for hosting video games.
Twitch's only business is streaming live video games. So they basically appeal to people who want to watch video games. And this puzzles a lot of people, especially I noticed a lot of older business reporters were somewhat shocked at the price paid for it. And when they looked into it, they thought it was something of a joke. I mean, how could someone pay $1 billion for a company that just lets people watch other people play video games? But it turns out there's a lot of people willing to do that. And the average viewership now on Twitch TV is higher than a lot of TV networks at the same time, higher than CNN or, you know, True TV. It's right up there with a lot of network TVs in terms of the audience that they're attracting.
We're talking right now with Lawrence Tabak for this month's Wisconsin Author segment. He's a freelance writer and the author of the new young adult novel. It's called In Real Life. We're back now talking with Wisconsin author Lawrence Tabak. He is a freelance writer and the author of the young adult novel In Real Life.
His new novel takes up the world of high-stakes gaming with 15-year-old Seth Gordon, who wants to conquer the world of video games. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been a spectator for online video games? Do you play in this world of maybe competitive video gaming, or you or someone you know? And as a parent, how do you navigate the issue of how much video game, computer game time, console game time to allow? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234.
Now, Lawrence, in your novel, your hero, Seth, he wants a life of the South Korean gamers who are, you know, rich and famous celebrities, more or less. He's got big goals when it comes to this. What is he hoping to do?
Well, I think a lot of kids have aspirations, and particularly kids that have a passion for something. And I was really interested in exploring that side of the world, particularly this new world of video gaming, which I felt was being sort of underrepresented in the literature. In fact, when I began thinking about this project, it was really inspired by the fact that my younger son was showing less and less interest in reading. And this is, of course, a painful thing for a parent who is a writer. And I asked him, would you be interested in a book if it had something to do with video gaming, something, a kid who was like you? And he said, well, sure. And so we went to find that book, and we couldn't.
Hmm.
So I think there's a lot of kids out there that probably can identify with the world that I portray in this book. And I was particularly interested in taking it all the way to Korea, because in Korea, the esports world is much more developed than it is in the U.S., and I think a lot of people always, you know, think that pop culture starts and stops in the United States. Well, here's a case where it's really much more developed in Korea. And I thought it would be sort of an insight into what's possible here in the States.
So it sounds as though in South Korea, there is a higher cachet with playing games like this. What is it like?
Well, to give you an example, there's two TV stations that play gaming 24 hours a day.
TV stations,
network TV stations. So it's a big part of the culture there. There's a lot of, you know, where we have 7-Elevens, they have neighborhood gaming parlors. The the players who are playing at the top of their particular games, as you said earlier, are really celebrities akin to, baseball players or basketball players in the United States. So it's really a big part of the cultural scene there.
And with your character, Seth, tell us a little bit, if you want to give away a little more of your book. He ends up in South Korea eventually, right?
Yeah, that's not a secret. It's right on the cover, so we're not giving anything away. But I was really interested in sort of the cultural phenomena and the culture clash that happens when someone is dislocated from their familiar terrain and put into a foreign culture. And he is in spades, because he's dropped right into a really hotbed of competitive activity without a lot of preparation for it. You know, he's a young kid. He knows he wants to be great at something, but he's not prepared for the world in which he's placed in. Well, I think that's true for a lot of adolescents as they, you know, go through their teenage years.
Well, let's go to our phone lines right now. We've got Kate joining us from Pierce. Hi, Kate.
Hello.
Hi, what do you think?
I think gaming is great. It improves coordination, and you can make lifelong friends.
Improves coordination. Have you found that in your own life?
Oh, yes.
Interesting. All right. Well, thank you for that call. It sounds like Kate talking up some of the benefits of gaming there, maybe some of the positives that, you know, maybe parents need to keep in mind.
Well, I think one thing that is interesting is the physical demands that are placed on gamers. A world-class gamer does about 400 actions per minute. That's how many clicks of the keyboard and mouse they make in a minute.
Wow.
So if you watched over the shoulder of a world-class gamer, it would be a whirlwind of activity. So it's not simply passive. I mean, when I was growing up, everyone worried about kids watching too much TV. Today, I think parents are in a similar bind with their computer gaming children. But it's a much different quality of activity. It's more active physically, and it's extremely intense mentally. It's like, I guess the best example would be like a chessboard that's constantly changing.
Hmm.
If you look at a gamer after a 30, 40-minute intense game, they are absolutely drained. So it doesn't surprise me that someone talks about the dexterity involved.
Yeah, that puts it in perspective. Thank you for that, Kate. And we move next to Donna in Brookfield. Hi, Donna.
Hi. I have an interesting comment. I wanted to let you know that I have a daughter who's 28 years old, and she's getting her PhD in anthropology, and her study is gaming, online gaming.
Interesting. Okay, so this is something that's, it sounds like, you know, not just your daughter, but this is something that's starting to be taken a lot more seriously, isn't it, Lawrence?
It absolutely is. And, you know, I think people forget how central gaming is to not only the lives of kids, but to humans in general. There's a book that was written 50 years ago called Homo Ludens, Man the Game Player, in which a philosopher, Johann Huizinga, talks about how central it is across the entire human species. And I think that is exemplified in this world, and as well as in all kinds of other sports and activities that become so important to people.
Well, thank you so much for that call, Donna. I appreciate that. And you know, my son is into Magic the Gathering, which you can play online. You can also play with good old-fashioned cards. And I just learned this year that, you know, being really good at Magic the Gathering, sometimes you can earn a full ride to college. And it made me think, you know, about the possibilities with gaming that you would have assumed as a parent were just, you know, frivolity, time wasters before. Do you think that it's time to change the way that we think about games?
Well, there was recent press release about a college that is offering a scholarship in computer gaming. I thought that was kind of shocking, but interesting. In terms of Magic the Gathering, Madison's a great town for games and for Magic the Gathering. We have a resident here, Bob Maher, who is in the World Hall of Fame of Magic the Gathering. And my kids were big Magic the Gathering players. My older son won scholarship money at the national competitions.
There you
go. So we have that in common.
Parents like to hear that.
Now, how was it transferring this real-life experience to the book? Did you borrow liberally from your experience as a parent, your experience with your sons, or did you try to bring lots of different other elements into this?
Well, I think a lot of the aspects of the sort of the mental side of gaming, the physical reality of what it takes are from my own life. But the story itself, it really takes off from there and goes in directions that are entirely imaginative.
And you've got your sons there who I'm assuming have both read it by this point. What do they think? Did you do a good job?
Well, the good news is they both read it. I think they liked it, but at the same time, I think it's kind of slightly embarrassing for a teenager to have a father writing about teenagers.
Well, maybe when they get older, they'll appreciate it more.
I hope so.
And what kind of response have you gotten? You couldn't find this book when you were looking for it when your sons were younger. You couldn't find a book about a young man passionate about video games, or a young woman for that matter. Have you written that book?
Well, I hope so. And I hope that other people will pick up the standard. The book is being widely distributed. It's been Barnes & Noble has committed to a national buy. I'll be doing a book event at the Barnes & Noble West in Madison on November 9th at 2 p.m. And I'll be in Spring Green at Arcadia on November the 2nd, both Sundays at 2 p.m. And the reviews and book bloggers have all been quite active in their interest in the book, so it's been really rewarding.
Now, having been through this as a parent, you and your wife were worried about all the games, especially that your eldest son wanted to play. He came out the other end. He's, you know, got a real job. Any advice you want to give parents out there who are struggling with this now, who have younger kids?
Well, I mentioned earlier balance, and I think that's important. I don't think that whether your kid is into gymnastics or football or video gaming, that it should be the only thing in their lives. But I do think I'm sorry, I lost the thread.
Advice you want to give parents.
Oh, yeah, I think parents should seek that kind of balance, but they shouldn't be scared of it, especially in the modern times that we're in, where computer skills are so important and so many things are being done through a computer, whether it's surgery or, on a different note altogether, drone controls. But I was surprised to see my kids one day playing a typing game where it was to see how fast you could type. And they were consistently punching out over 100 words a minute, 130 actually. So, you know, that's got to have some value in life.
All right. Well, Lawrence, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And by the way, you can catch Lawrence Tabak at Acadia Books in Spring Green on November 2nd, and at Madison's Barnes & Noble West on November 9th. He's a freelance writer and the author of the young adult novel called In Real Life.